As a child during World War II, I can still remember the thing that impressed me most about attitudes during the war. It was an attitude of hope that soon all the boys would be back home, life would be back to normal, and two or three men who were bathing the earth with blood because of selfish ambition would be somehow stopped. Then the end of the war came and homes were reunited. But instead of a fulfillment of that hope for tranquility, it seemed that with the fall of China to communistic influence, with the development by Russia of the secret of the atomic bomb, or the capturing of that secret, the gathering of it, with the various things that came to cloud our post-war world, instead of peace and tranquility, we entered a new era of restlessness and hopelessness. So that modern man has virtually lost the concept of hope from his real life. He may talk about it, but he sees life, or tends to see it, in a rather cynical way. Just a bit of despair leads him to be cynical, doubtful about whether things are going to get better. A great deal of despair can lead to something much more serious, like suicide. In a world which never had it so good, a world which has less problem with poverty, fewer ravages by incurable diseases, less real toil for daily bread, less real threat of starvation than the world has ever known in the past, we still haven't been able to find real happiness. Hope seems so far away from us that these words from Jesus warning about the destruction of Jerusalem seem to be written for our time. Men fainting with fear and foreboding of what is coming on the world. It isn't unusual that, or unthinkable, that someone with a new religious sect can read these words and apply them to the present time and convince numbers of people. Because our world is a world of fear rather than a world of hope. And yet that passage, 1 Corinthians 13, has come to mean a lot to our time. Love has become so central to so many movements and appeals that even the closing verse must be a part of our memory. They abide these three, faith, hope, and love. And the greatest of these is love. It just may be that in our time, one of the greatest at least is hope. One of our most striking needs is to get something to live for. After all, everybody hopes for something sometime, and life isn't much without hope. Hopes have a way of shaping our character, our personalities, our destiny, determining the kind of people we are. The word hope is used in the New Testament by a rough count. I haven't gone through to exactly count it in the concordances that would provide that kind of information, but it's used roughly 50 to 60 times. The word promise is used a similar number of times. And it's the promise of God upon which the hope is based. The New Testament has a great deal to say about hope. The early church was a hopeful church. They lived in watchful expectation. They had an anchor in God. And even though persecution, about which Jesus warned in the Beatitudes and about which he gave an attitude men should assume if they were his followers, even though persecution raged, there was still hope. And yet in our time, without the persecution and with many more reasons to hope, apparently, we tend to lose that hope. 1 Peter is next in our sequence of looks at Old Testament or New Testament books on Sunday nights. Many of you have read it by now, hopefully a good percentage of you. But 1 Peter has been called an epistle of hope. That isn't the only title it's ever been given. Persecution is such a prominent factor in the book, sometimes it's called the epistle about persecution. Among its more common titles by people who've written commentaries, full-length studies of the book, would be the epistle of courage, or the epistle of hope, or the epistle of pilgrimage. Either one of those is an appropriate title. It is a book about courage. Courage under hardship. If one reads the book, he's struck with the way Peter wants the Christian to be somewhat like John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. Some of you will remember the work in which the character named Christian seems to be able to set his face like a flint through wind or weather and just go on with valor toward the goal he's pursuing. It isn't the kind of courage that withdraws from the world and forgets the outside problem, pulls inside a shell, and with a stoic attitude that the world is never going to be a very happy place, but I can suffer through it and I will put up with anything rather than deny my faith. It isn't that. It's an epistle about really valiant courage. It's such an epistle about pilgrimage, seeing life, that is, not as a permanent thing, but we're all pilgrims here. We're just passing through, straying pilgrims, traveling toward another life. Such an epistle of pilgrimage that some commentaries have linked this with it more prominently than any other theme. One has noted that the epistle shares a great deal with the Old Testament patriarch Jacob, who seemed to always live as a pilgrim. He was forever traveling, never did seem to be able to put down any roots, always looking for another place. Abraham and Isaac were like that to a great extent. And 1 Peter is a book about pilgrimage, the pilgrimage of the Christian life, but it is dominantly a book about hope. This is its real message. I think most of us have, if we're Christians, at least a confessed measure of hope. We say everything will be all right. Somehow things will work out for the best. But it is not a wistful, vague sort of optimism that the Bible is talking about when it discusses hope, or that 1 Peter is pushing for in our lives. It's a religious hope. It's a hope which really believes that because God is in his heaven, everything is all right on his earth. That because God is in control, somehow all evil will eventually be overcome, and there is hope. There is a reason for joy, real joy in the midst of life, despite suffering. And that is 1 Peter. We'll take a while to look at it, but that's it. Real joy in a time of suffering. Each time we've taken up books, we've usually talked for a moment about the author and the recipients of the books and something of the occasion that prompted the book. I think that's vital. If you're going to do a study in your own home, you need enough books on the shelf eventually to help you find something of the backgrounds of the book, because until you know the message for the people to whom it was written, the message for their time, living people in a living situation, one just can't know the message for our time. The author is Peter. He starts it by saying, Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ. That's a bit striking to me because it may not seem to be at all, but 2 Peter doesn't open that way. It says, Simon Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ. But why the difference? Maybe there's no real reason, but I think there probably is. You see, Peter was his Greek name, Petros. And that leads me to believe that Peter's writing this book to Gentiles, people with Greek backgrounds. He was called by several names in the New Testament. If you'll notice the way Paul talks about Peter in his writings, Paul nearly always calls him Cephas. That's his Aramaic name, and Aramaic was a form of Hebrew that was spoken in New Testament times by Jews. Hebrew is the older language spoken in the Old Testament period. Aramaic is an adaptation of it. And while Greek language and influence has been spread through Palestine, many of the Greeks still spoke their native tongue. And Aramaic was common, and Cephas was Peter's name in Aramaic. So when Paul writes the Corinthians about their divisions, he said, some say I'm of Paul, some of Apollos, some I of Cephas, and I of Christ. A little later he says, all things are yours, whether Paul or Apollos or Cephas, life or death, things present or things to come. Or still a little later in chapter 5, don't I have the right to carry about a wife, even as the brothers of the Lord and Cephas? Certain other of the apostles, and I have as much right as anybody else to marry a wife and carry her with me. Or in 1 Corinthians 15, when he's reciting the resurrection appearances of Christ, he says he appeared to Cephas, then to the 12, and after that to above 500 brethren at once. In Galatians, when he talks about going up to Jerusalem and staying 15 days with Peter, he says it was with Cephas I abode 15 days. In Galatians 2, when he talks about pillars of the church and then a mistake Peter made by refusing to eat with Gentiles, each time it's Cephas. In Acts 15, when James was standing making that speech to a group of Jewish brethren in Jerusalem who really thought that maybe circumcision should be required of Gentiles before they could be Jews and then they could be Christians, James stood and said, James the brother of Christ, Simeon hath declared how that God visited the Gentiles to take out of them a people for his name's sake. Simeon was his Hebrew name. Tribe of Simeon, remember, one of the sons of Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel, one of the tribes of Israel. So Peter's name depends on the people being addressed. And the fact that he writes Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, indicates to me he's writing primarily Gentile people. He associates with himself in this writing in chapter 5, verse 12, near the end of the book, Silvanus. This is apparently the same man we know as Silas. In Acts 15, when some men were chosen to go with Paul and give down the decisions that had been reached at Jerusalem about circumcision, Silas was one of those men. Another, the other man was named Judas. In Acts 15:22, he's called one of the leading brethren. In Acts 15:32, he's called a prophet. He went with Paul on his second missionary journey, wound up singing praises to God with Paul in that prison in Philippi. Paul refers to him, as well as himself, as a Roman citizen in the closing verses of Acts 16. Silvanus was a prominent man, and he is associated with Paul and Peter both. So the author is Peter, and he apparently uses Silvanus or Silas as his amanuensis, his stenographer, to write what he tells him to write. Paul associates Silas with himself in the opening of the two letters to Thessalonica because he visited there on the second missionary journey and Silas was with him. So much for the author. Peter writes it to the Christians of the dispersion in a number of places: Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. Now, without a map, we'll just have to imagine where this is. But they're all five parts of Asia Minor. They're actually names of ancient kingdoms. And now they've been given to provinces in the Roman Empire, and we call Asia Minor Turkey. It's north of the Mediterranean Sea. The interesting thing is, how did the church get there? Paul visited Galatia. He preached in Asia. Ephesus was the chief city there. But in Acts 16, 7 and 8, Paul was forbidden to preach in Bithynia. There isn't any record of his ever going into Cappadocia or Pontus. When did the word get there? Part of the answer is found on the day of Pentecost. Acts 2, 9 lists people from some 15 nations, and among them are Cappadocia, Pontus, and Asia. Maybe some of those people carried the gospel back to their native lands. Maybe Peter himself had preached there on occasion. He had been to Antioch, and this is west of Antioch through the Taurus Mountains. But somehow the church has been started in Asia Minor, all across it, a thickly populated region. And Peter writes a letter to these people. The occasion, we can't be quite that definite about. It appears to be a time of persecution, because there's so much in the book about suffering persecution. There was no empire-wide persecution within Peter's lifetime that we know about by the Roman Empire. If you remember from the book of Acts, the Roman soldiers, guards, leaders were the ones who often protected Paul and saved his life. And yet, on the 19th of July, 64 AD, a terrific fire broke out in the city of Rome. Rome had narrow streets, tall wooden tenement houses, and it was ready for a fire to just sweep through it if one ever got out of control, and this one did. It raged 3 days and three nights, and when it was finally checked, it broke out again. The populace of Rome was satisfied in their minds that Nero himself had been responsible for the fire. We know of Nero's own account that he sat on a tower in a tower area and watched the city burn, and he talks about the flames as being flowery and lovely. He had a passion for building, and apparently he wanted to rebuild the city to his own glory. It had to be burnt down first. There were men going through, hindering people trying to put out the fire, and others setting fire again where it seemed to have been put out. A great persecution resulted from that, because when Nero was blamed, he had to pass the blame to somebody else, and he picked the Christians. There were some easy ways to do that. These people had been going around predicting the end of the world with fire, destroying the earth, and that seems to have made it rather easy for people to believe them. I'm sure you've heard this many times, Nero's account. So I thought it might add a little something to our understanding if I read you a bit of it from Tacitus' Annals, a history book of the time. Neither human assistance in the shape of imperial gifts — king couldn't give away enough — nor attempts to appease the gods — he couldn't offer enough sacrifices — could remove the sinister report that the fire was due to Nero's own orders. There wasn't any way the king could get rid of the rumor. And so, in the hope of dissipating the rumor, Tacitus says, and he was no friend of Christians, he falsely diverted the charge on to a set of people to whom the vulgar, or the common, gave the name of Christians, spelled with an E, and who were detested for the abominations they perpetrated. Christians were accused of idolatry or atheism because they wouldn't worship the gods, and incest because they called one another brother and sister and met after night for their meal together, loved each other, exchanged the holy kiss, and so on. You know some of the charges. The founder of the sect, one Christus by name, had been executed by Pontius Pilate in the reign of Tiberius. And the dangerous superstition, though put down for the moment, broke out again, not only in Judea, the original home of the pest, but even in Rome, where everything shameful and horrible collects and is practiced. Tacitus says, if there's anything bad in the empire, we get it, and we got this. And Nero needed a scapegoat, and the Christians are the ones he got. He has no friendship for Christians, but he still sees through Nero. A little later, he describes how those Christians were persecuted. Mockery of every sort was added to their deaths. Covered with the skins of beasts, they were torn by dogs and perished, or were nailed to crosses, or were doomed to the flames and burned to serve as nightly illumination when daylight had expired. Nero offered his gardens for the spectacle and was exhibiting a show in the circus while he mingled with the people in the dress of a charioteer or stood aloft on a car. Hence, even for criminals who deserve extreme and exemplary punishment, there arose a feeling of compassion, for it was not, as it seemed, for the public good, but to glut one man's cruelty that they were being destroyed. Tacitus looks at the Christians being torn apart by dogs or being made torches for the night in Nero's garden and says, even people like this shouldn't be punished like that. Probably as the result of that persecution breaking out, Peter writes to warn the brethren in Asia Minor and to give them moral courage for the suffering they may be called on to go through. Well, that introduces the book to us. What does the book actually say? Well, the book has in it some three dominant motifs. One of these is suffering under persecution. All through the book, we're told Christ suffered for us, leaving us an example to follow his steps. When we suffer, we're not to revile again. But here's an excerpt that will give a better idea than just brief statements. Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal which comes upon you to prove you, as though something strange were happening to you. But rejoice insofar as you share Christ's sufferings, that you may also rejoice and be glad when his glory is revealed. If you're reproached for the name of Christ, you're blessed, because the Spirit of glory and of God rests upon you. Let none of you suffer as a murderer or a thief or a wrongdoer or a mischief maker. Yet if one suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but under that name, let him glorify God. That's from chapter 4, and a little later in chapter 5, Peter says, resist him, the devil, firm in your faith, knowing that the same experience of suffering is required of your brotherhood throughout the world. So Peter is warning that all over the world, the worldwide persecution is being threatened by the Roman Empire. Now, the persecution was not to be borne up under as if it's evil, we have to suffer it, let's grit our teeth and go through. There's rather an attitude in 1 Peter that if you'll be the right kind of people in this suffering, you'll be bearing witness to the teachings of Jesus Christ by your own conduct. If you'll just show what it means to be a Christian by the way you suffer, don't retaliate. There's something redemptive about that. If you can suffer as he did without answering back in kind, then you're going to receive the reward for having suffered. So it's this kind of attitude toward persecution that 1 Peter is built around. There's a second major motif in the book, second major purpose, and that we would call ethics or morality. Briefly put, this means being a martyr is no substitute for being moral. You can't use what you suffer to make up for the wrong you do in life or the good you leave undone. So Peter builds a great deal of teaching into the book about living the Christian life under all circumstances. This appeal for ethical conduct takes several different forms. One is a warning against all the typical sins of pagan people. In chapter 4, for example, he says, live for the rest of the time in the flesh, no longer by human passions, but by the will of God. Let the time that is past suffice for doing what the Gentiles like to do, living in licentiousness, passions, drunkenness, revels, carousing, and lawless idolatry. They're surprised that you do not now join them in the same wild profligacy. They abuse you for not living this profligate life, this loose, dissolute type of existence. But they will give account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. So Peter is saying, don't follow their terrible conduct. They're amazed that you don't live as you once did. But put all of that out of your life. You'll remember other passages. Put away malice and evil speaking, he begs at the beginning of chapter 2. But this is typical. Don't live like the pagans around you live. There's a second ethical standard he erects. Be good citizens. That would be hard for me if the empire were leading the persecution. The emperor is worthy of honor, not worship, but give him honor. I think I would be prone to speak quite in an evil fashion about the government. Most of us living in a land very free from persecution still are quite free in what we say about our government. Instead of the sort of prayer the New Testament so often exhorts us to render for the government, regardless of which party leads it. In chapter 2, verses 11 to 17, Peter talks about citizenship. Beloved, I beseech you as aliens and exiles to abstain from the passions of the flesh that wage war against your soul. Maintain good conduct among the Gentiles, so that in case they speak against you as wrongdoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation. Be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether it be to the emperor supreme or to governors as sent by him to punish those who do wrong and praise those who do right. For it's God's will that by doing right you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish men. Be good citizens. That will silence your critics. Live as free men. Yet without using your freedom as a pretext for evil, but live as servants of God. Honor all men. Love the brotherhood. Fear God. Honor the emperor. I think if Nero had been on the throne, that would have been one of the hardest lines I would have ever read. Honor the emperor. And yet Peter says, be good citizens, in order to show the beauty of the Christian life. There's a third emphasis in the book. You people who live in groups, communities, congregations as Christians, show the right kind of treatment for one another so the world will see what it means to be a community of Christians. I'm picking out another special case from chapter 4, beginning with verse 7. The end of all things is at hand. Therefore keep sane and sober for your prayers. Above all, hold unfailing your love for one another, since love covers a multitude of sins. It's a strange, strong statement. Love covers a multitude of sins. Practice hospitality ungrudgingly to one another. As each one has received a gift, employ it for one another as good stewards of God's varied grace. So we serve one another, realizing that love covers a multitude of wrongdoing. We're a community of people together. But there's something more. Stay away from the pagan sins. Be good citizens. Live with love in the community of Christians. Your families have to be watched too. Let your families be examples of love in a pagan society. In chapter 3, verses 1 to 7, another rather lengthy reading about family life. Likewise, you wives, be submissive to your husbands, so that some, though they do not obey the word, may be won without a word by the behavior of their wives, when they see your reverent and chaste behavior. Let not yours be the outward adorning with braiding of hair, decoration of gold, and wearing of robes, but let it be the hidden person of the heart, with the imperishable jewel of a quiet and gentle spirit, which in God's sight is very precious. Some have taken this so literally that they've been very concerned about wearing a golden ring or a golden watch. I think a careful reading of the passage will alleviate that type of interpretation. Wearing of robes or putting on of apparel, as the King James puts it, is wearing clothing. And Peter is not saying that one should wear no clothing. He is rather saying that the emphasis in one's life is not to be on the expensive taste in clothing or the beautiful braiding of the hair or the gold one wears. The emphasis is on that meek and gentle spirit in the heart. I don't mean to tilt the scale too far, for I think we can spend too much of our interest and other things on the outward adorning. But at the same time, Peter is not condemning all adornment of oneself. He is stating where the emphasis in life is to be. The real beauty of the Christian woman is the gentle and quiet spirit, in God's sight, very precious. So once the holy women who hoped in God used to adorn themselves and were submissive to their husbands, as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord. And you see how you are now her children, if you do right, and let nothing terrify you. But that isn't all, not just the wives. Likewise, you husbands, live considerately with your wives, bestowing honor on the woman as the weaker sex, since you're joint heirs of the grace of life. in order that your prayers may not be hindered. While the woman is to be submissive, the husband is to be loving, or else his prayers are hindered. Family life. There's one other element in the book that's very strong, and it's an element of watchfulness and trust, looking for the coming of Christ. Again, we'd almost have to read the whole book to get everything about waiting for his coming. Expectant Christian living. But in chapter 5, verses 6 through 9, there is an outstanding case. Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, that in due time he may exalt you. Cast all your anxieties on him. He cares about you. Be sober. Be watchful. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. Resist him. Firm in your faith, knowing that the same experience of suffering is required of your brotherhood throughout the world. And after you've suffered a little while, the God of all grace, who has called you to his eternal glory in Christ, will himself restore, establish, and strengthen you. To him be the dominion forever and ever. Amen. So Peter says, you're going to suffer. Don't retaliate. And that kind of suffering can accomplish something. Then live the kind of life Christ wants you to live. That involves staying away from those pagan sins, living the right way in the community of Christians, being good citizens, even in the Roman Empire, having the right kind of families. With these attitudes mixed with watchfulness and trust for the coming of Christ, Peter sees the Christian life developing into hope. I mentioned three fundamental things make up the book: persecution or suffering, moral, ethical, Christian living in those times and in ours, and finally, there is the note of the good news that causes all this to be real in our lives. Why should I suffer like that? Why should I be willing to undergo whatever? Peter, his answer would be because you've heard the good news. Because you know that Christ was crucified, buried, raised up. And now you're born anew. You've been crucified. The old man has died. You've been buried in baptism and raised up. In 1 Peter 1, the closing verses of the chapter go into this. You've been born anew, not of corruptible seed, but of incorruptible. For the word of God which lives and abides forever. I think we can rightfully say that in 1 Peter, crucifixion and resurrection are welded together. Christ died on the cross and he was raised up. It's almost as if Peter was saying, now you Christians have been raised up. You were baptized. You've been raised up to the new life, born anew. Now you may face a cross. Reverse order for you. But you may face a real cross in suffering and persecution. Just as Christ suffered the cross and there followed the glorious resurrection, so you've had the resurrection to the new life and there may follow the shame of the cross. The two are together. And once they saw this, suffering could be endured. For our times, when persecution is social rather than physical, when the cost is in taking a stand for Christ and his way of life in the midst of a society which often thinks that out of step, out of date, a great deal of hope can be had from 1 Peter if we see it for ourselves as well as for them. Most of our despair, our hopelessness, is due to the fact that we wear the name Christian, but in a practical, working, everyday fashion, we're pagans. Everything may be better, but we don't really hope in God. We're not really convinced that everything's in his hands, that he is going to guide the world, including our lives. That kind of hope isn't easy to build, and I don't know any of us who has perfectly built it, but it's basic to Christianity. And the more of it we have, the more filled with joy, regardless of external circumstances, Christian life becomes, so that the Christian, again, as it has so often been put, has a joy that the world can neither give nor take away through Christ. And that's the joy you can have by being born anew while we sing.